in New York, the trial of four men accused of bombing in the World Trade Center bombing gets underway today. The February explosion caused by a car bomb killed six people and injured more than 1,000. The defendants could face life in prison if convicted.
It turns out that his name is Mohammed Salami. But at the time, I'm talking to him, and I introduce myself. I'm Ken Strange. I give him my business card. And then subsequently, after the World Trade Center is bombed, there's a newspaper that came out, and his face is on the front cover. And it says, "The Face of Terror." Right. So what this character was doing is he was actually working on behalf of Saddam Hussein, and specifically the Iraqi military group. And they were sourcing out equipment that could be used in Iraq, anything from computers to even, you know, there were materials that could be used to not renovate or actually to patch up runways that have been bombed. So he was sourcing, anticipating the Gulf War. So he was, and then these centrifuges for isotopes and nuclear things. So he was sourcing out everything for basically the Iraqi military.
Mm-hmm.
That's what was going on.
So can you highlight then, because this is a number of the stories that we're kind of talking about, you know, during your time with the Joint Task Force, is focus on a lot of these different Arab groups, Arab extremist groups that are kind of within the U.S., but this was all the time building towards what you just highlided, the first Gulf War. So can you maybe explain what the situation was happening at the time and why there was starting to be that buildup and like there was that feeling in the air that we were going to war?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, as you know, Saddam and Iraq had taken Kuwait by force. And, you know, the United States policy was, you shouldn't have done that. And that's not what countries do. And Saddam had gripes with the Kuwaitis. He considered them to be spoiled, arrogant, selfish people, and they're sitting on the oil fields that should be his, right? So that was all happening in the background. And meanwhile, you know, we're in a area where it's, one of the heaviest populations of Arabic people in the country, that and Detroit. So, you know, we're keeping an eye on, Saddam is our adversary. So we're looking at anyone that has contacts with Saddam. And again, people that were Ba'ath Party members were Saddamites. And so you had to, you want to definitely be vigilant and see who they were and find out what are they up to, especially when people are traveling just prior to the war, going back and forth like a lot. So something is up. So
yeah, it's interesting too, because a lot of people, that time gets glossed over because of what eventually happened on 9/11, that it was like, it was such an extreme that people kind of forget that.
Yeah.
Like 9/11 wasn't the starting point.
No.
It was kind of the...
Oh, it was building. It was building. And, you know, and I say, and you know this in my book, we were watching the early stages, the beginning, the infancy of bin Laden in our own country.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, for example, Said Nozair, which was one of the people I mentioned in my book. This is the guy that killed Rabbi Kahani in Manhattan. So he's part of all these fundamentalists, Egyptian and other folks, Palestinians. And so, he's part of that group that then they have spiritual guidance from Omar Abdulrahman, the Sheikh, the blind Sheikh. And meanwhile, all of these people are basically in the shadow of bin Laden, because bin Laden is over in Sudan. He was in Saudi Arabia, then Sudan, then Afghanistan. And he's kind of, calling the shots here. So this was all really the beginning of Al-Qaeda, the absolute beginning. And I was there on the ground for that.
Can you highlight this quick too? Because you were in Saudi Arabia at the time. A lot of people don't know this about bin Laden, but I heard you say this on another podcast and just it's been referenced before. You were seeing a ton of construction signs when you were around Saudi Arabia. So can you maybe highlight that quick and just helps people put in perspective.
Yeah, I sure was. It was astounding because you know, every day I would go to the school, you know, I'd have to pass at least four or five bin Laden signs on the roads, the bin Laden construction company. And so I would ask, who's this guy bin Laden? And, you know, I was told, oh, he's actually a Yemeni that had come up to Saudi Arabia and had started working for the royal family and had done such a great job, you know, with the construction of this grand mosque in Mecca that the royal family decided to keep him. He was the go-to guy for construction projects, and which were prolific, as were the number of wives that he had too. That was prolific as well. And bin Laden was, you know, the progeny of one, from one of those wives that he had.
Yeah, most people don't realize that, like, because there was such a, I don't even know if it's pop culture, but just an idea that they were living in caves and, you know, they thought bin Laden was from a poor country in the Middle East. And it's mm-hmm. like, no, his family was
no.
nigh billionaires.
No. I mean, he was, you know, my understanding, he was a spoiled kid and he did spend time partying in Lebanon and Beirut, which was, you know, kind of a party place for Saudis. If they weren't going to Thailand, or richer ones would go to London and Paris, but the others would go to different places. But yeah, no, it was amazing that, you know, and we're about the same age, bin Laden and myself. And sometimes I think, my God, you know, he was in Jeddah, just, you know.
Not, yeah, right not, down
not,
the street.
Yeah, yeah, not too far from me. And maybe I even ran into the guy. Could you imagine?
Oh my God.
That's in the next book.
Okay. I see.
Spoiler alert.
I see.
I can't get over my skis on that.
No, we'll have you on when that next book comes out, okay. And then we'll get into that.
So fair enough.
That's a good teaser. Man. All right. So you mentioned the name El Sayed Nasser.
Nozer.
Can you dive into that story as well? Because like you said, these are foundational. A lot of people don't, like we were saying, understand mm-hmm. what was happening mm-hmm. at that time, mm-hmm. but these are foundational
yeah.
pain points
yes.
that led to the eventual boil-over that was 9/11. So
Right. Yeah, so I mean, he's one of these Middle Easterners that decides, you know, he's going to come to America and, you know, find a future of some sort. But when he gets here, he finds out life's tough and, you know, it's not easy being from the Middle East and, you know, living in America. It's, you know, there's going to be some pain to that. And, you know, he gets together and he falls in with a group of kind of like-minded young men who are frustrated with their lives and what's happening with, and so they get very affected by these preachers, these imams in these mosques. So they kind of join together as kind of a group of these fundamentalists. And Nozer is kind of the beginning of all the problems that, you know, go right through to the first World Trade bombing and then 9/11. It really starts with him. So again, like I said, he's the gunman. He murders Kahani, who was a, you know, rabble-rousing Jewish rabbi, you know, who is maybe part of the Jewish Defense League as well. But he you know, Said Nozer kills him, tries to flee. He shoots an off-duty, I think it was a marshal's guy. And then he's arrested. He's finally arrested. And, you know, then we're called in, C-10 is called in to kind of go out there to his house and collect, you know, the evidence. I remember I was part of that team carting out boxes, 20, 30 boxes from his apartment in New Jersey. He was married to an American girl who had converted to Islam. I remember that. And, you know, then the rest of it, he gets off, but then he's back in prison. And then from prison, he's working with his other Confederates. You know, it's like a gang of these jihadists in the New York, New Jersey area.
So what was C-10's feeling at this time? I mean, this is like where you're saying, they've been watching a lot of these groups for a number of years, but now we're again, starting to go towards that boiling point.
Yeah.
Like, was there a level of anxiety or like, I guess, what was the feeling in the task force at that time?
Well, look, the feeling was, I mean, there was so much going on at the time. I mean, when I stepped on board, they were still investigating Japanese Red Army, a guy that, you know, Yuki Kimura, who had you know, come over here to bomb the Navy station in Manhattan, right? But so there were so many things going on. So this was just one other thing at the time. So again, I'm not here to bash my colleagues, but and understandably, they hadn't done anything in the Middle East, so they really didn't know the ins and outs of Middle Eastern people and what they what their aspirations and their frustrations were. So it's interesting because the New York Police Department handled this as a homicide, and there was a point where they could have handled it as a joint terrorism thing, which they did not, because the NYPD had decided, no, it's just a homicide.
It's a crazy guy.
Yeah. Now there were other people, and there were some in NYPD, and I know them as a matter of fact, who've come out and said, I remember going before, at the task force and trying to tell them this is bigger than that. This is not a homicide. This is something else. This is coordinated. There's a plan here with these guys. Something is going on, but they were kind of poo-pooed. No, we don't. So, I think that was the attitude from the beginning. And I'm not saying that I saw right through it it soon became apparent to me and then to the other people on the squad that there was more happening here. There's more at work. There were other characters that were fomenting, and there were other signs that and here's part of the problem. We have a New York task force and a Newark task force. But we're operating, and we knew their FBI agents and their task force, great people. And I actually tried to get us together more often, and that's in the book. But we were operating in our own silos. Like New York was their own animal. They had their own informants, their own issues, their own jihadists, and we had ours. But what was happening is that, these jihadists would live in New Jersey and work in New York, right? So we're just going back and forth. So and I mentioned this in the book. I just wish we were kind of more together, united, these two JTTFs, because we had a lot in common. And that became very apparent. We had lunch in New Jersey, and we're all talking, oh, you know that guy? Oh, we're on this guy too. You're kidding. Oh, and what? You're no kidding. Oh, well, look, I have a guy can help you. And, over lunch? We could have done so much more, I think. Unfortunately, it didn't work out too well.
Yeah, no, that I know you touched on that in the epilogue, and that's definitely something that we'll dive into a little bit more because I think it's a pretty important message, and it's also in regards to American people, they should have an understanding of that and also look towards how policy is dictated. Right. But continuing with like you said, the couple of years that you're working on this, it's one of the most high stakes times, stuff's ramping everywhere. Mm-hmm. One of the other crazy stories that popped up was an apparent assassination plot on President Bush at the time, correct?
Right.
Can you dive into that case and I guess, what the ramifications were with that?
Yeah, that was the case of Jamal Waryat. And this was he was a naturalized U.S. citizen from the Middle East. I think he was Palestinian roots, but had been raised in Kuwait, I think. And he was in the U.S. Army at one point. So apparently he calls over to the Iraqi embassy or the consulate or someone Iraqi affiliated and says, starts threatening Bush, George Bush, the father, and other people, other politicians. And so this was a serious threat. We find out we have a Secret Service guy on the task force. So we go right into, where is this guy? He's right in our neighborhood. He has a store in Newark, and I think he lived in Rutherford. So I just remember we convene, and we have an acting supervisor, and we know where the guy is. He's in this grocery store, which he seems to run or own. And so I said, look, we can find out some stuff right now. I volunteer to go over there. My backstop will be as some kind of a graduate student and who speaks Arabic, lived in the Middle East. So I could pull that off, right? Mm-hmm. So they say, okay, go for it for now. Be careful. And so I go out to this place. And I'm comfortable because I know that people are watching me. There are surveillance units. So I go into the grocery store and I, you know, I engaged the guy. And, he's like, oh, you speak Arabic? Oh, quiz, alhamdulillah, inshallah. And we're really kind of hitting it off. But as we're hitting it off, I'm kind of trying to find out about him. Where are you from? And, oh, you know, and so I gathered intelligence is what I was doing. And at the end, and this is where I kind of screwed up, which is in the book. And, you know, I said, I'm Mr. Please, he said, please, this guy, please give me your name. So here, I'll put it on a piece of paper. I'm Mr. Richard or Mr. Richards, whatever mm-hmm. I was. And then I put my real phone number down there. I didn't think it through. I just automatically put the phone number. Wish I hadn't done that. So I go back to the squad. Wait, what's going on? What happened? So this is what happened. Okay, that's great. Good. Okay, good. Now we'll, you know, now we know more about the guy. You know, he doesn't seem like he's going to be killing anyone next few days. We can sit and watch him, the whole thing. And I said, boss, I got to be come clean with you. I screwed up. And he, what do you mean? And I said, you know, I gave him my bogus name, as we agreed to, but for some reason I gave him my real phone number. Oh, my God. This guy, my boss reamed me out. I never felt so ashamed, and I felt so bad, you know, right in front of all the squad. And I screwed up. I fucked up. And but he, you know, in the end, he said, "Hey, we'll let it go. Let me help you get a new phone number. You know, we don't want anything happening to your family. We just didn't know who this guy was or what he could do. So we're better to err on the side of caution." But so what happened after that is they decided to again, you know, they took this threat very seriously. And the Bureau did what it does best. It threw all these resources into this. And so we were watching this guy at his home and at his store 24/7 for several months. And then they got an undercover guy who was a professional undercover, had worked on so many great cases. And when I heard that he was being pulled into the case to make contact with our guy, Jamal, I knew it was over because this guy's a thespian.
He's the guy.
Oh, he's the man. I mean, you know, he's a legend. You know, he's in the Smithsonian magazine about some great cases. So I knew that Jamal was no match for this guy who spoke Arabic fluently, lived in the Middle East, and it was over. And that's what happened.
So Jamal ended up coming forward and like...
Yeah, he was arrested in the end. You know, he gave up what he was. Yeah, he started giving plans to our undercover. Yeah, I want to do this, and we could take out these military bases. And but in a certain way, Jamal was all talk because he didn't really have those people to assist him. But still, you never know. So they had to shut it down and say, just take this guy down. Yeah. You know, you never know. He may take a rifle and kill somebody. So it was a great case, and they arrested Jamal. By that time, I was no longer with the FBI; I was with another federal agency. But it worked out well for the squad, and I'm happy for them.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And plus, I feel like more of those cases happen than people realize as well, which is scary. But it's like situations like that are developing. Like you said, it's not as simple as oh, he made a threat; we can just go arrest the guy. I mean,
right.
You
have to scope it out. How big is the threat? Who's involved? Yeah, exactly.
And is there a countdown clock there as well? You guys are like 24 valence surveillance and everything, just making sure that if this guy decides, hey, today's the day, I'm going to go for it. You're like, all right, we're ready to go.
We're ready. Yeah, they were ready. Really ready in spades. Mm. And again, the final part was bring in, the undercover, the master undercover guy, and let's clear up anything else. And then after that, we'll pull the plug.
Did you ever feel a level of humanization or sympathy is not the right word, but connection with some of these individuals when you were talking to them and kind of dissecting, you know, their decisions? We were talking about Mike earlier.
No way. I mean, these other creeps, these other jihadists, I mean, we knew they were up to no good. And I remember going up to the mosque there. I'll be honest with you. I was there to surveil, but I was always there. I was there to make a point, too, that we're everywhere. We're ubiquitous. We're watching you. Of course, there weren't many of us, but let them think that they're being watched 24/7. But I knew the mindset. I knew these guys. And then there had been a murder of a rival imam to Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, the man, the imam. His rival had been snuffed out by these guys. And so I knew that they were murderers. You know, Syed Nozer was in jail. He killed Kahani. And I knew these other guys had murdered. The guy's name was Shalabi, Mustafa Shalabi in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. So I knew that. I knew they were bad people. So I never once, with these cats, never, never, never. And you know, it's funny. We went into a, this was in, I think, Paterson, New Jersey. We went into a Arabic coffee shop, my partner and I, just to kind of, this was during the Gulf War. We were astounded. All these young men were in this coffee shop watching CNN, and I'll never forget this the rest of my life. And I think Trump made a point about this. He may have heard it, not from me, but he heard about it. But I swear, I was with my agent friend, Hank. We went into this place. These guys are watching CNN, and these are the Scud missiles that are flying into Saudi Arabia, killing our people. And you know, in Saudi Arabia, our soldiers. And these cats are yelling, Yella Scud, Yella, Yella, Ham, you know, praising Allah. Go Scud, go. You know, just wishing mayhem and death on our people. And I just, holy shit, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
You know, I got so pissed off. And this is my country, and you're in here, you know, in my country, backing Saddam Hussein and backing the murder and mayhem that he's creating and killing our soldiers, men and women. This is insane. So I never felt any empathy for these guys. Mm-hmm. Never.
So there is one more story that I definitely want to dive into, but was there any other kind of key highlights you think that were happening at that point that really stuck out to you that you think were either definitive of the time or had a direct impact just on your career up to that point, or I guess your mindset while being at the FBI?
Mm. You know, I can think of one other case in which I went over to Brooklyn to look into the Shalabi murder because I knew there was something about it, and I thought, hey, that the police precinct, he was murdered in the police precinct where my father was a police officer, so I was like going back to the old place, so I went in there and. It was at night, and I remember the desk sergeant, and he said, what are you doing here? And I said, you know, if you have any of this stuff on the Shalabi murder, I'd like to look at it. And he goes, they're foreigners. What do you care? And I said, I care because they're foreigners.
Yeah.
So, you know, I went in there. He's very nice. He gave me all the stuff. And as I started to go through the stuff taken out of his apartment, I started seeing stuff from North Carolina, from Fort Bragg, lots of stuff. Like, and I thought, wait a second, where is Shalabi getting all this stuff? Not realizing, it was just the beginning of this realization that there's something bigger going on here. And, you know, there were manuals on how to make bombs, on weapons, and just some crazy stuff. Why does this guy have all that? So, and it was just a treasure trove of contacts that he had and stuff in Arabic. And I said, this is really good stuff. So and I gave it to my squad and I said, please look at this stuff. I think there's something going on here that just doesn't smell right. And that apparently that never happened, unfortunately. And I'm not going to point fingers. And who am I to say I was gone, right? I left. But what this was pointing a finger at a double agent, a triple agent. He was a Egyptian who was living in the States. He was formerly with the Egyptian army. He was a fundamentalist, closet fundamentalist jihadist. He comes to the States and now he's working in Fort Bragg. He got a job with the military. So what he was doing is he was getting all this stuff and sending it to his buddies up in Brooklyn and New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, but then, and the New York task force saw some of this. He would also go firearms training in Long Island with some of these guys. And he was, you know, he's training them. He did a lot of training. And, you know, and there's a book about him, Sergeant Ali Mohammed. And then he was not only that, but then he would take these trips. He would, you know, get off. He'd go to visit bin Laden. He's hanging out with bin Laden. He's doing security for bin Laden. And then he's also involved in the embassy bombings as well. He's casing the joint, casing our embassies. So, you know, again, if I could go back in time and do it over again, I probably would have stayed, you know, knowing what I know today, because that would have led right to this triple agent. And, you know, maybe the embassies, it's hard to say, you know, it's maybe not fair that I say that, but I just sometimes wonder, what if?
Does the ignorance around, because it seems like it's kind of a commonality where, you know, you highlighted what's happening here, highlight with NYPD where they originally treated the murder as just some lone
homicide,
psycho.
Yeah.
Was the ignorance around the situation pissing you off? Like, how'd that feel? Because especially you, I mean, we've highlighted this, the background in the Middle East, the understanding, like.
Yeah. You know, I don't think it was, again, I don't think we could see this coming. I mean, I knew about the forces that were out there and I took it seriously, but we were so engaged in so many things. And you know, if you screw up, you know, there are dire consequences. Not just that evidence that I took out of Shalaby's locker, but even before that with Said Nozair and the 30 or something boxes that we had, you know, I figured there might be some pretty good stuff in these boxes. And I know that we, C-10, had it for a little bit of time. I don't remember if it was a day or 2 days or a week or whatever before we turned it over to either the JTTF New York or to the NYPD. But it turns out that these boxes were not looked at. They were not opened until after the first World Trade bombing. And inside these boxes were all kinds of things. Again, Fort Bragg, how to do this, how to do that. And a lot of stuff that had we opened it up and looked at it and really dedicated our time to these to this evidence, you know, who knows?
Who knows what could have avoided?
Yeah.
It's actually where, to wrap up, I guess, the terrorist talk.
Yeah.
The 9/11 bombings, so a lot of, or not the 9/11 bombings, apologies, the World Trade Center bombings, a lot of people, again, we're highlighting this, is everyone thinks it all started at 9/11, but it wasn't the first time that Trade Center had been hit.
Right.
You speak on this and you speak on a dream that kind of develops around this.
Yeah.
So can you maybe speak to that situation and the feelings that kind of surround it?
Yeah, I mean, it's painful. The first World Trade bombing is painful because we had people killed. I think there were five or six people that were killed. One was a pregnant woman. You know, I'm sitting back watching this play out, and for some reason I felt guilty. Why hadn't I stayed longer? Maybe, you know, I start torturing myself with this idea. And so I don't like watching. I would just get so sentimental, and I'd feel so depressed to see it on television, you know, the World Trade Bombing 1993, you know, I didn't do enough to stop it. Maybe I could have done something. So, you know, that's why this dream sequence plays out for me where, you know, I go back in time with Hank, my partner, and we stop them dead. We stop them right there, whatever happens, but we stop them. So it's just something I have to live with.
Mm-hmm. And I know too, I mean, you highlight this as well. You had an interaction with one of the apparent bombers on a train, right? It's kind of
eerie
connection.
Yeah, eerie connection. What a coincidence, you know, that this person would play a role in the bombing. And where do I meet this guy? In the World Trade Center.
Can you speak to what led to that and everything?
Yeah, sure. So this was a Christmas party that we, C-10 was invited to in New York. They had a party and they invited us to come over. I went with Detective Sergeant Kevin Torme, who was with the state trooper. So we went to the party there in New York. We had a great time, but we had to get back. You know, we have to get back on the other side of into New Jersey. So we had to go to the PATH train. And who do I run into one of these jihadists? And I knew he was immediate. I saw the long beard. And I said to Torme, I said, hey, that's one of the Sheikh Omar's guys, for sure. He goes, oh, come on. Yeah. How do you know that? I said, I know that. I just know that. So you know, we're on the train, he's in our car. And I said, I'm going to talk to this guy. And he goes, oh my God, you talk to everybody. And I said, no. So I go over there and I start talking to this Palestinian guy. It turns out that his name is Mohammed Salameh. And he turns out to be one of the bombers from 1993. But at the time, I'm talking to him and I introduce myself in Arabic. And he's like, whoa, his eyes were like big as saucers. And I said, hey, you know, I'm Ken Strange. I give him my business card. Now his eyes are even wider. You know, FBI, it says on it. I say, hey, you know, so we're talking and I'm asking him questions. Where are you from? Oh, I mean, I lived in Jordan. I'm Palestinian. So, you know, I'm kind of trying to get some intelligence.
Prodding a bit.
Right, yeah. Prodding him a bit. And at the end, you know, we get to the end of the line and he says, I got to get off. And I said, hey, this could be the beginning of a great relationship. You know what I'm saying? And he goes, yeah, I think I know what you're saying. So I said, how about your phone number? And he says, no, I got to go. And off he went. But I remembered it, you know, I just remembered his face. And then subsequently, after the World Trade Center is bombed, there's a newspaper that came out and his face is on the front cover. And it says, the face of terror. And that's when I saw and I said, holy shit, I know this guy. And I gave him my card, you know. And then I remember saying to my wife, I know this guy. And she goes, oh, come on, you're exaggerating. I said, no, I met this guy, and you're never going to believe where I met him. And then I remember calling my squad. And they called me. My boss called me. And he said, Ken, we did a search warrant on this guy, Mohammed Salameh. And I said, I know where this is going, Dan. You found my card in there. Yes, we did. We found your business card. What's going on? And I had to explain it to him. And it's kind of funny because I mentioned that to my mother. And she said, oh, son, I know you didn't do it. I know you weren't involved with them. And then, no, Mom, that's not it.
That's not what's happening.
No. But yeah, no, it was pretty freakish. You just, again, wonder if and, you know, again, hindsight is 20/20, but, you know, maybe knowing what I know now, I, you know, would have definitely kept him in sight. You know?
Yeah, probably. Somebody,
yeah, for sure. Yeah. But he was out there with these jihadists. There were a bunch of them.
Plus, if it wasn't him, it was going to be the next guy.
Next guy, right.
You know. Yeah. You had some journalists hit you up as well about that situation, correct? With, you know, the trying to create a narrative that wasn't there.
Yes, I mean, exactly. That was like I was being had, you know, that they were using me. That they wanted me to say things that were untrue,
mm-hmm.
you know, that I knew all about this. I mean, what a story that would have been.
Yeah, their idea was
you knew about, you knew about it and you did nothing, or you're involved, some involvement, or, you know, some sensational story. But I said, no, that's not the way it went down. I'm sorry. I had nothing more to say.
Did that change your outlook on journalism at all?
Well, it opened my eyes.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, they have their job and they want to do their job, and their job is much different from what we do. So be careful.
Mm-hmm.
Watch what you say, if you're going to say anything.
Yeah. How did those on the team react to when you kind of broke down the story and everything as well? Or even the fact that journalists were trying to manipulate
yeah,
it?
Yeah, you know, look, I had moved on to another agency, so yeah. I never got a chance to talk with them about that, really. Never had a chance to discuss it.
Mm. So let's go to more lighthearted measures.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
The Castro story is
hilarious.
And I'm a bit confused by the ending, so I kind of want to, like, that's why I had to talk about it.
Yeah, sure.
Like, what happened?
Yeah, sure.
Can you, I guess starting from the top, like, you end up finding this individual going back and forth from Cuba.
So well, he finds us.
He finds you guys, correct.
That's right. He's a walk-in.
So can you highlight this story, I guess, just where it all kicks off?
Right. So, you know, one of our responsibilities was Cuban intelligence because, you know, we have a large Cuban-American population in New Jersey. So, you know, Diaz was our guy, and he was working that aspect of intelligence. And I don't know if he had moved on, transfer, or if he was out for something. And so they asked me to do it as a collateral duty. They said, would you step in and help us out on the Cuban desk? Si, si, bueno, como no, como no. So this guy walks in and he's an American businessman and he loves fishing. Turns out he loves fishing. He says, I know stuff about Cuba. I can help. You know, that type of thing. I can help. So, you know, I sit down, I interview him, and he says, hey, I do some fishing in Cuba. I go down there and I do business in Cuba. And, you know, I'm actually, I'm friends with the Castro brothers. I'm like, come on, get out of town. He goes, no. I mean, you know, I'm respected. And, you know, they have this Hemingway fishing contest and I'm into Hemingway. And, I donate money to keep Hemingway, the whole thing going and that whole thing. So I'm like, well, so what do you want? And he says, well, I'm going down there on a fishing trip. So, you know, I'm going to participate, but then, you know, I'm going to see the Castro brothers.
Yeah, meet with the guys.
Yeah, right. So I said, then I find out, you know, there's this embargo on, and you shouldn't be doing that really, right? So I said, that's all on you. I said, you know, I can't tell you what to do. You know, you're going down there is even maybe suspect. But, you know, if you hear anything, let us know. We left it at that. And then the next thing I know is he calls me and he said, hey, I'm just about ready to go down there. You know, I'm going to fly down to Florida and the Keys and take my boat down to Cuba and fishing, the whole fishing tournament. But there's this guy that I just met him. He's a really nice guy. I think he's from Israel. And he's also a fisherman.
What are the chances of that?
Yeah, what are the chances? So he's going with me. So now I'm looking into his background. I'm thinking, oh, Christ, this sounds like a Mossad-type arrangement. So he goes down there, and then the next thing I know, I get this call about a week later, 10 days later, from I think it was Customs, and they said, hey, there's this guy. he was in this fishing tournament. You know, he's not supposed to be down here. But there were a lot of Americans down there doing the same thing. He goes, he's working for you. And I said, no, he's not working for me. I know who he is, but he's not working for me.
Name drop in the FBI.
Yeah. Get out of jail type thing. So, I said, no, just, he goes, well, we took a lot of his stuff. He got one of the biggest, Marlins in the tournament and we confiscated that. And I said, good. We also took some Cuban rum off of him and good. That's good. And so I didn't think anything about it after that. You know, I just figured I haven't heard from him. You know, I'm not going to be proactive. You know, it's him coming to me. If he finds something out, okay, fine, I'll listen, right? And then this videotape shows up.
Yeah,
from him. And I'm like, huh?
So can you highlight the videotape? Because that blew my mind.
No, I mean, it was bizarre. I mean, it was... I get the tape and I remember going upstairs, downstairs into another floor where they had this cassette player, a VHS player. I put it in and it was bizarro. Mm-hmm. You know, it's him. First of all, it's him at the Hemingway monument or the Hemingway house. And I'm thinking, okay, well, that's what he said he's doing. It makes sense. But then he's with Teofilo Stevenson, the Cuban boxer. And I said, wow, that's, I know boxing. And that guy's a great boxer. You know, he could have beaten Ali, I think.
Yeah.
In his prime. And I said, well, this is really, he's really in Cuba. He knows some people. And then the next thing, and there's the Israeli guy always with him as well.
Like a
remora fish, you know?
You highlighted that. You're like, this guy's a ghost. Like, were you pretty locked in? He was probably a Mossad or something.
I think so. Just, you know, go figure. I mean, at the last minute he shows up. Hey, I'm a fisherman.
Big fisher.
You're going to Cuba? Hey, I'd love to go with you. Yeah. I can keep you good company. You know, I can talk a lot. I can even juggle.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing you know, I'm seeing these guys with Raul Castro, and they're in some kind of a tunnel. And he's, he's going on about, oh, I wish the U.S. relationship was better with us because the times were very, you know, we didn't have a very good relationship with Cuba.
Still don't.
Right. And so, you know, he's it's kind of like he's fishing for some, you know, feel sorry for us. We're not a big threat. However, I'm here in the tunnel and we have some, there's a tank and there's a howitzer and that, you know, and I'm thinking, holy God, what is this? It's like passive aggressive. Like, we want better relations, but if you attack us,
we're ready to go.
We got a few tunnels here. Check it out. Yeah. So I'm just freaking saying, what's going on here? And then like it switches to they're in, you know, some office and there's again Raul Castro, and this time Fidel is with him. And they're talking, and there is our guy, and there's the Israeli guy, you know, they're drinking, they're joking, and you know, it's Spanish going back and forth. And then you know, peace to America, peace to our countries, this, that. And then at the end of the tape, Raul Castro looks into the, I guess it was a camcorder, and he says, Agent Strange, are you getting all this?
Holy, that part, like, oh my God.
I cracked up when I saw that, and I said, oh boy.
Holy shit.
This is going to the Department of Defense or the CIA or both.
Yeah, so you sent it over to them. What was, I mean.
You know, I just, what I think was going on is that he was kind of making overtures to the United States. Like, look, we're a friendly nation. We've fallen on hard times. But, you know, we will defend ourselves if we have to, but we'd rather not. And anyway, I don't know. After that, what happened, I never saw this businessman again. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, hopefully Castro wasn't too angry.
Yeah. I'm just wondering. So, you know, he's still alive.
Okay, so he's
still alive. He's in his 90, 91. Okay. And I thought about.
He didn't get the Putin route then.
I thought about, I don't know, it's kind of fantasize about going down there with my book and, you know, great promotion.
Take a picture. I mean.
Why not? Anyway, yeah. Why not? Except that, you know, Cuban intelligence. I do want to come back home.
Yeah. So would they, oh my God. Who do you think broke then? I mean, yeah, this is all hypothetical, but who do you think broke in that? Like, did they figure it out that he was working with the FBI, or was he, do you think they sent him up to like be able to coordinate?
I think they worked him to get a message out to the US government, mm-hmm. which was successful. They, you know, it came to me and it went out to the Department of Defense and the CIA. So I think he got his message across, and I think that was the purpose of the you know, the show all video.
Yeah.
And you know, they seem like very nice guys. Like, you'd want to just hang
out
a
cigar
and
them.
Party with them, right?
Yeah.
They just seem like nice, and they, you know. So I think that's what was going on.
Do you think they sent him to your doorstep when you guys first met him, or do you think that they just figured it out?
I think it was on his own volition that he came to us, and then they kind of co-opted him.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, the passenger that he took on at the last minute, it'd be interesting to really find out who that guy was.
Yeah.
And what he did after the trip. And, you know, maybe he's in Tel Aviv.
Yeah, no, because it's funny. Like, you guys got good information from the video, but also kind of got to saw what's going on.
Yeah.
But they, like, turn off the camera, and they're like, all right, now time to show the real stuff. Yeah. And he's like, yep, I'm on your guys' side. And exactly. Then, you know, they end up showing him the nuclear launch codes or whatever, not that they have them. But, yeah, whatever they got. He's just like, I'm bringing this all the way back.
Yeah, for me, it was hilarious.
Yeah.
In the end, it was hilarious.
Oh, I was reading. I was in disbelief where to have, I mean, you know, it would have been one thing for even one of the two individuals to be the ones that leaned over, but you getting all this.
Yeah.
The fact that it's Castro's brother is just so surreal because it's, I mean, those are like in a weird way of all the leaders that have happened around the world.
Right.
You got Putin, you got Xi right now.
Right.
Scary guys. Go back then, you could pick whatever leader of the Soviet Union or, you know, what. Most of the time, the world leaders are like, you're like, I'm kind of scared of those guys. But what you're highlighting with the Castros, like, they definitely did some bad stuff.
Yes. Oh, yes.
But they had a vibe.
Yeah. You know, he came across so convincing, Raul, that you almost wanted to be his buddy.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, you're pretty cool. But then you realize, you know, the people that he had assassinated. Then you have to stop and say, whoa.
Yeah.
Do probably really want to be friendly with him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's what, yeah, it's fun. Because it's weird. And Cuba, maybe it's because it's an island country and it's not Russia.
Right.
But yeah, it's funny. It's like those are the only world leaders where it'd be like comedic for them to look in the camera and be like, you getting this? And you're like, oh my God.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was not easy getting that story through the FBI. You do know that, you know, I signed an agreement with the FBI when I joined the FBI so that if I publish anything afterward, they have first rights to see the book. And that's what happened. And they were with my book for about 16 months. And so that's why in the book you do see redactions. You've seen them,
mm-hmm.
right? So, and it was interesting because I'm kind of switching over here. Please forgive me for that. But
no, go for it.
When they went through it, I was surprised when it came back to me. I was surprised that they let some stuff through that I thought, if I were them, maybe I wouldn't let it through. I would redact it. And there were some things that I thought were totally innocuous that they decided to redact. And it evolved into a negotiation at times. Like there's one story in there, The Goiter Man. Well, I didn't think that there was too much in there for them to worry about or to keep out. And yet they redacted half the story.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were, other things that like Crow's Nest that went right through, hardly a blemish. So, go figure. But it was not easy kind of waiting around. And then we'd negotiate and then, okay, you can put this person in there, but you have to change his occupation or her occupation. And then when they tore apart the one story, I came up with Crow's Nest to kind of, make up for that previous story. So it was, I guess you could write a book about that process.
I was going to ask, so what do you think, as much as you can get into it, is there reasoning behind like a lot of those decisions and stuff? Is it just ongoing cases? Is it just?
No, I think it's protecting sources and methods.
Okay.
Yeah, they just want to, that's a big thing. I mean, if everybody's out there exposing, our informants, openly, then who's going to want to be an informant,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's what they say. We're just protecting sources and methods.
And how does that litigation work? Again, if you're able to speak to it, like going back and forth and being like,
well, yeah. These are, the reviewers, there were some attorneys involved as well. So once in a while, I'd get on the phone and, I guess we would negotiate.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they said, hell no, we're not going to, no, it's got to be like that. And other times we kind of work together to get it out without, compromising.
Out. Yeah,
sources and methods. So we worked together on it. It was an interesting process. And not only that, but not only was the FBI a stakeholder in this, but Justice Department had to see it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think AID also looked at it, but they didn't have anything there. Department of Justice, they had maybe a handful of little edits, but it's the FBI that had the
majority. I was going to ask, are other agencies, like CIA, I feel like, would they be in, do they do anything with this?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. They weren't, no. And it's funny. I'll let it. I don't want to get too into the.
That's why I know it's like,
yeah, I got to be careful.
Back and forth on that. So jumping into USA and I guess wrapping up time with the FBI. I guess first, what was the decision there to jump from FBI to this new opportunity? I mean, it was.
Yeah.
A new unique opportunity. So what was the calculus there?
Yeah, I mean, so I left after the Gulf War pretty much. So after the Gulf War, there was a lull in our activities. And at about the same time, I met an ex-FBI agent in Newark. And he was with this Agency for International Development and with the Inspector General's Office. So we had lunch and he said, man, we could use someone like you. You got the overseas, and we're a very small group, so you'll travel a lot. And, I love traveling. I love seeing, other countries. Oh yeah. And we could put you, your Spanish speaker, Costa Rica is a place where you could work. Would you like to work in Costa Rica? I said, absolutely.
Yeah. Wouldn't be a bad spot.
Yeah. So, then there were other former FBI agents and I thought, and I do like the international part of things. So, I decided to try it. And I thought, if it doesn't work out, maybe I can get back with the FBI. So, that was my reason pretty much for doing that.
Yeah, and I mean, in a couple of years, too, you had enough of a career. I feel like you'd be like, all right, maybe take a step back from
it. Well, it's funny. It's funny you mentioned that, Connor, because I remember when I left, they had a party for me in the office. I mean, C-10 threw the party, but a lot of people came. And I remember one FBI agent was one of these cynical guys in the back and as the party wound up and I walked past him and he said, yeah, good luck. He said, strange. I don't get it. You're here 3 years and you get a party like this. I mean, how does that work? And I said, well, I was busy.
A fun guy. Yeah. So let's go to Costa Rica. I mean, yeah. We were talking about this before jumping on the pod. It's just like a hilarious story. A pretty notable group, especially recently, Hezbollah actually put out a hit on you. So could you talk about...
Hold that thought. I don't know. I ended up on a list, but to this day, I don't know what the list means. It could be a hit list. It could be... I don't know. We just don't know. But, you know, that whole thing, again, the FBI, I was in Costa Rica now with my new job, and I got a call from a unit chief in D.C., and that's when he said... we've been looking for you, you know, and I said, yeah, I've been out of the bureau for 2 years. Well, we found you. We just found you. And we feel we have to warn you about something. And I'm like, oh, what is it? What? And he said, you know, we've had several sources, and these are corroborated, two sources corroborated, that you're on a list, a Hezbollah list. And I said, oh, great, you know. And then, you know, there's another FBI agent on that list. There's a CIA officer on the list as well. So there's a total of three of you. And the information came from one of our northern neighbors. I'm not going to say the country.
Yeah.
I said, well, what do I do? You know, what kind of list? And he said, I just don't know. We don't know what kind of list that is. But we're just giving you a heads up. We feel we have to do that. We should do that. Are you packing? And that's, you remember in the book, mm-hmm. I said, you know, packing, you mean to leave?
Yeah, I'm in Costa Rica. I'm not leaving.
Yeah. And he said, no, packing as in a gun, you know, do you have a gun?
Yeah.
And I said, no, we don't carry weapons overseas. So he said, well, you know, you should report this to the RSO, regional security officer, which is what I did. But so to this day, I don't know what that meant, but I must have, and look, I did not work Hezbollah matters. So I must have, you know, in my day-to-day over there, I must have bumped into people that had affiliations with Hezbollah, and maybe they just didn't like what I was doing.
Yeah, I mean, you highlighted this as well. Like, it seems like when you look at a lot of these guys, they have multiple affiliations.
Yes.
Or they're like, they're part of this group, but they're actually part of a subset group that's actually part of this group. And it's...
That's right.
You're such an inner web of activities that, you know, you can end up on something without even...
That's right. Well said.
Purposely doing that.
That's exactly right.
So nothing ever really came of that, or is it just...
Nothing ever came of it. I mean, you know...
Thank God.
For a few years I was kind of looking over my shoulder, mm-hmm. but then, you know, with time, it's like, you know, why would they want to do anything to me? I'm out of the scene. They probably figured out I don't work there anymore. So, yeah.
So moving from the FBI, you joined the USAID. Can you maybe explain what that is and what, cause.
Yeah. I mean, this is this was a pretty recent agency. I mean, it goes back to Kennedy, 1961, where they administer aid to our foreign partners, all kinds of aid, you name it, you know, foodstuffs and monies, and they support contracts and subsidize different things. So we were basically this Inspector General's office of AID, and so we had oversight to, I don't know, 40,000 employees or however many there were, and to all their programs that distribute aid. And when you're distributing aid, there's a lot of money circulating. And so there's the opportunity for fraud.
Yeah, a little bit of stuff disappearing.
Right. And you know, we were a very small group. We were kind of like a secret, this little secret in the government. And right away, you know, you were kind of your own, you know, I need to go to Russia. You know, I ended up in the Ukraine once. Or, you know, I'd go down. My area was eventually Central South America.
Mm-hmm. So what was the initial training or first steps into joining that organization? Because it's obviously very different from Joint Terrorism Task Force.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we're talking about Tom earlier, like it's more similar akin to, you know, that side of
white collar fraud.
Exactly. So what was the first few steps there?
Right. So, you know, there was a learning curve for me because I didn't have a fraud background. But what I did is I latched on to two fellas, former FBI guys who were, you know, had an accounting background, fraud background. And I just talked to them all the time. I learned as much as I could. I went with them on their cases. I watched, I participated, and I slowly learned, you know, how to put together a white collar fraud case. So, it, you know, in the beginning, it was a little uncomfortable for me. I was in a kind of unknown territory, but I soon got the hang of it. And yeah.
What was the first standout case where you really felt like you're like, I'm good with where we're going?
Yeah, well, you know, there was that simple fraud case out of DC where the, you know, the contractor to the agency, you know, this was a contractor based in Maryland. And then this guy was working, you know, as a contract employee, and he was basically providing, these were like supplies to the State Department and to the Agency for International Development. And I got a tip from one of the ladies that was working for AID in the in that department. And she said, hey, you got to see this. Come on over here. I'm going to show you some paperwork. So she shows me the paperwork. And we have all these, she said, these supplies, take a look at all these briefcases and this color film and this product and that product. These are inordinate amounts of supplies. They don't make sense. We've never seen this spike in these supplies being ordered. So, you know, then finally I started making a case. Who's the person, who are the people that are involved? Well, it's, you know, this contracting guy, he's a supervisor. So I kind of looked at these people. And then basically I had to take what was ordered and then go to each department and
be like, you got it.
Right. And, you know, I'd go all over. So it took about maybe 8 weeks to find out. And what was interesting and what got me really interested is, you know, we'd see 40 briefcases. And so I'd look at what they ordered, and it was like two briefcases. So the disparity, something was, we didn't order 40. That's what's going on, Mr. Strange. We'll find out.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, so we put it all together, and then, you know, we realized it was this guy. And I had heard also that he was into drugs. I found out talking to some of his friends. And then I remember we opened a case with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Baltimore because the contractor was in Maryland.
Yeah.
And yeah, well, let's do a case on this. Let's issue him a subpoena. So we did. And that's when we got a call from his attorney saying, yeah, Fred wants to talk to you guys. And that's when it broke open. And real nice guy. You know, you talk about empathy. And I mentioned it in the book that he was actually a very soft-spoken, nice guy, but he was a crack addict, and so I felt sorry for him, and he admitted I did this. I ordered all these things, you know, what'd you do with them? And he said, the briefcases, the film, that's on the street, that goes really quickly.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, sell them on the street. What was interesting is the film, the Kodak color film. He sold to a camera store in Arlington that was run by Afghanis, two Afghan guys. And so, you know, our prosecutor said, you know, would you do an undercover for us, a kind of sting operation, and we'll consider that for your sentencing. And he said, yes. So that happened. We did that as well. So I said, how did you do this? You know, I understand, you know, you order all these things, they come in, you know, you're feeding your habit, but your supervisor signed off for this stuff because his name is on, you know, on the end of the paperwork. Mm-hmm. And he says, oh, I knew that, you know, every time I'd approach him, it was Friday about 3 o'clock, and I knew he liked to go home early. So I would just put all these papers and he would say, oh shit, I'll just sign. He's not even looking.
Oh man.
So I tapped into that.
Yeah.
You know, and then when I told the boss that, he's like, oh shit, oh my bad. Thank you for telling me. I won't do that again. So it was just sad because it was during that crack epidemic. And I just remember it was kind of poignant because when we met at the U.S. Attorney's Office, it was the defense attorney's office. And you know, he says, can I have a lift home? I don't have wheels. And then I said, I'll take him home. And then his attorney says, that's odd. you know, that doesn't happen much. You take him off. I said, no worries, no worries. And as we're driving home, he's actually loosening up and he actually feels like a relief. He's relieved to get this off his shoulders. And, you know, he told me, yeah, I was in the army, you know, this and that, but I unfortunately, I have this terrible addiction. And then I just remember letting him off in D.C. and just I didn't feel good. I didn't feel good about it, about prosecuting him.
I was going to say, God, it's a tough one because, like, is it a relief to go from stone-faced psychopathic killers to at least someone you can humanize with? Or does that make it, was the job tougher, I guess, would be?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on the personality. I knew some of these people were stone-cold killers and others are not. This guy wasn't. You know, he could have been any other life. He could have been my friend.
Yeah.
Could have played hoops together, right?
So it's just kind of just the case to case.
You got a sickness. You have an addiction. I get it. Mm-hmm. You got to feed the addiction. I get it.
So moving forward, we jump into the DOJ, and you are entering at a pretty crazy time in terms of the situation that you're, where you're going. So you're going down to El Paso. Can you maybe highlight, I guess, like what the transition was, why you decided to move to the DOJ, and then what El Paso was looking like at the time?
Right. You know, excellent question. And so I had to reflect on where I was at the Agency for International Development, Office of Inspector General. I had done some wonderful things, traveled to many, many countries and worked fraud cases, many of them successful. But there came a point with management where I saw my chances as limited, as limited moving forward. So I was starting to get disappointed. And there was one case in particular that didn't go the way management wanted it to go, although, to be honest with you, I didn't see it going any other way. But when that happened, and it was kind of interesting because when that happened, I kind of got this, I got a phone call from someone who said, hey, Department of Justice, OIG, heard about you. They're interested in you. Would you consider? And I said, yes, I would consider. And sure enough, I got a phone call from the special agent in charge of the El Paso office and said, hey, you know, I saw your resume. I like what I see. Come on down here. I'd like to interview you. I'll fly you down here and back. And then so it was such a great experience to be wanted by management in this particular case. And then when I went down there, we had an excellent time together. Met his family, had dinner with him. And I said, you know what? This is like another chapter. I'm now on the Mexican border. I speak Spanish. So this could be a pretty cool opportunity. So I took it.
Yeah. Life works in a funny way too.
Amen. Amen to that.
And you're going to the border too, man. And you're going at a time when the border was hot. And Juarez specifically, which for people that don't know, so you're going down to El Paso. El Paso and Juarez are neck and neck.
Right across. You can see right across.
And can you highlight, I guess, why Juarez was as crazy as it was at that point?
Yeah, drugs, narcotics. The cartel that kind of operated in our area and was the biggest cartel in the world at the time was the Vicente Carrillo Fuentes organization, or VCFO. So they were, you know, running drugs over the border, into El Paso and then on to distribution in all of our cities. So they were the big name in town. This is before they started all their internecine conflict and killing each other, and before the Zetas and the Renaissance or the New Movement or whatever they're morphing into. But this was the Vicente Carrillo Fuentes group.
Can you explain how that group came to prominence? Because like you said, it is at that point was the most powerful cartel.
Yeah.
And with Amada Fuentes was kind of the kingpin at that time. And then, you know, as we continue on, you actually get to meet some of the other individuals that led to this. But can you maybe highlight how the Juarez cartel came to be?
Yeah, I mean, I think if I recall correctly, it was just another tentacle to some of the other cartels that were, although the biggest player, but there were other players too, and they were kind of all interconnected. So you had the Arellano Felix organization, the Sinaloa cartel, all of these kind of in Baja, Tijuana, and down in those parts to Arizona. And then Carrillo Fuentes was also related to some of the other players as well. They just happened to have the biggest distribution routes and areas, but they were all connected either by, you know, by blood or by close working ties. And they just became bigger and bigger and bigger. And then, you know, when cocaine became the thing, and it was not just marijuana, you know, there was more money involved. The stuff was coming from Colombia, you know, became more deadly, more money. It became crazy.
Yeah. No, I know. I mean, we'll speak about Miguel in a little bit. But.
And they squeezed the Miami corridor to some of the drugs. So the, you know, that was all kind of tapped down, buttoned down. So now everything started to go through the Southwest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, I know Juarez at that time, so Amado was the original kingpin for them. He got super popular for basically just flying everything right over.
Right.
And Juarez was also the biggest route for the border at that time. So they were just
right.
cashing in. But with drugs and money always comes extreme violence. So Juarez at that time was top-notch, one of the most dangerous cities in the world. So can you speak to that as well, moving directly across the border? And
yeah, I know, look, when I was there, the big problem was with these missing women, and you'd hear about it all the time. And if you went over to the Mexican side, which we did, you know, we stayed in the tourist zone. We'd cross the border and stay in the tourist zone. But you would see placards and flyers saying, you know, looking for this woman, that woman. And there were tons of missing women. I don't know why that was. Maybe it's part of the whole drug trade. But I knew it was dangerous for women. And then as it evolved and more drugs and then more competition, it got more and more deadly.
Yeah. It's one of the craziest situations as well, because it's like what happens down there. I've had a number of narco journalists on. And it's like one of my favorite topics to go into. Mm-hmm. It's just because it's so insane. But how everything operates as well is it's like an ebb and flow. So you have certain cities that, you know, are the new power kingpin, and stuff just goes to absolute shit real quick. So one of the quick stories I wanted to jump in was the corruption at the border. There's always been corruption at the border. Again, when there's drugs and money, there's violence and corruption.
Sure.
Can you highlight the story of Callum, I believe his name was, and, you know, basically the corruption at detailed around there with Juarez?
Yeah. So, you know, part of our job as OAG, we had oversight of all the justice components, you know, personnel and their programs, again, pretty much like AID, same idea. We had oversight of the INS, Border Patrol, Bureau of Prisons was pretty big. I did a lot of prison work as well. Marshals, the Marshal Service, that crazy case there, kinky case. So we had oversight of all these departments. And I forgot the question.
I was saying for the corruption case with Colum at the border.
Okay. Yeah. So we had, oversight of all these departments. With Mr. Callan, I would see a lot of this. These are guys that would come to Texas. They come single. They'd meet some beautiful Mexican girls. Some of them were innocuous, and some of them were related to cartel people. Unfortunately, in his case, he married a girl that was pretty tight, had family relations with the Vicente Carrillo Fuentes group. So, you know, they work on these people, slowly but surely. And I believe it progressed from him doing favors and taking chances on immigration documents for family members, you know, that type of thing, until finally they said, hey, there's big money. If you're at the port of entry, you know, you're the gatekeeper, you wave cars through, you stop them. There's a lot of money in this for you if you just kind of wave our stuff through, you know. So that's pretty much how that evolved. And, you know, his character, again, his moral compass was just not there. And, you know, it's just too much temptation for him. And he gave in.
How often were you guys seeing cases like that where corruption was, a cartel would find somebody in the Fed ranks and just try to slowly break them down.
Yeah, you know, not a lot, but you know, enough to keep you busy. We had, again, and you know, I talk about drug cases, but there were also prison cases as well. But just enough of these drug cases to keep you hopping.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be Border Patrol. And it could be, you know, INS like Callan. But yeah, but again, in our situation, because we were small, I would have to depend on, you know, assistance from other agencies, interagency cooperation. So I, and, you know, I'm that type of guy anyway, so I love to work with other groups. So I, you know, tap into the public corruption unit of the FBI in El Paso, work with them, or Customs Office of Investigation. So I got to know, you know, El Paso's a small place. So I got to know all of these people, and we would work together, pool our resources together to make cases against some of these corrupt individuals.
So I definitely want to dive into some of those prison cases you were highlighting, because those are going to be incredibly interesting. But I guess before just kind of wrapping up some of the more details with the cartels, you did actually do a visit to the Altiplano, which is
Altiplano, yeah.
Altiplano, yes. Which is, to make it simple, the prison that El Chapo evidently escaped from.
Yeah, maximum security.
And you met some very interesting characters there. So
oh,
I guess.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Can you highlight what that trip was?
Yeah. So this is part of the Merida initiative. And I had, you know, I applied for this, and they green lighted me to go to Mexico and to work with our federal counterparts in Mexico and to assist them in establishing an office of inspector general. So I did that. I made two trips to Mexico, a few weeks each. And I got to know, you know, I got to know a lot of federales as well. Great, great relationship I had with them. But during one of my trips, the head of the PGR, their attorney's office, said, "Hey, why don't you go out and go to our, you know, I know you work Bureau of Prison Cases, so why don't you check out? We have a prison that's you know, we're very proud of this maximum security prison. So why don't you check it out?" And so I went with someone from from Justice Department DC, Howard. And so we visited the Altiplano. And, you know, as it turns out, when this, we had the breakfast with the warden, right? And the warden's like, "Oh, no one can ever break out of here. It never happens and never will happen." And you Americans, and he's lecturing us on you Americans. And I saw this movie where this helicopter comes into the prison and they escape, and you Americans, you know, and I'm like, okay, where is this coming from? But then he says, we finish up the breakfast and in his office, and he says, "Would you like to see some of your American prisoners?" And I said, "No, I'd like to see some of your, you know, Mexican prisoners, the top ones." And he goes, "Oh, okay." He wasn't too happy. And so before you know it, I'm just a few feet away from some of the most heinous cartel guys in the world.
Yeah, I mean, that part was... I didn't expect that.
Neither did I. It was unexpected. And, you know, as I mentioned, I'm in the cell, and they're all like kind of lumped together. There's Miguel Gallardo,
Felix Gallardo,
and he's whining about his underwear. You know, it's
what was the feeling when you see, I mean, again,
pathetic.
Yeah.
Pathetic. I see the guy and he's moaning and bitching about his underwear. He said, "Look, warden, look, it's wet, mojado, you know." And then he's got this this is, I didn't understand. He says, "There's no way the communications with cell phones and for the however many miles outside, you know, are disconnected and they can't." And yet this guy has a television in his cell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of a broken black and white television, but it's, why? Why is that? Why would you even have that in the cell?
Some money.
I guess maybe you're paying someone off. So meet him, and you know, then I'm like, whoa, you know, this guy, he was involved in the death of one of our DEA agents, right?
Kiki,
right?
Yeah.
So I'm like, whoa, number one, I can't believe I'm here. Number two, you're such a pathetic piece of crap.
Yeah.
You know, that type of thing. And then next to him in another cell is one of the Arellano
Felix brothers.
Yeah, brothers. Now he was very quiet. He was very polite. You know, I'm talking to him in Spanish and "Sí, señor, muy bien, cómo está usted?" You know, that type of thing. But there was something off about him. You know, and I
later, in what way? Like, how do you mean?
Maybe a little touched, autism or something. Oh, okay, something going on. And then later, I found out there is something maybe going on with him. And then finally, let's get away from here. I'll take you to our new infirmary. Everything is scrubbed. You know, the nurses, doctors look great. You know, everyone has been polished, and it's all staged.
Right? Yeah, and good old propaganda.
Yeah, but there on the gurney, sitting there, you know, pulling his shirt off, is this hirsute person, and he's moaning and groaning. And I instantly went over to him and I said, "There's a story here," and I said, "Señor, how are you?" He goes, "Oh, no muy bien, no muy bien." And he started telling me about his problems, and only to realize later that he is in fact
Don Neto.
And I didn't know Don Neto. I knew very little about him, to be honest with you. But later, when I started going through the Wikipedia, and then I said, "Holy shit! This guy was a major drug kingpin. I mean, I think he's
Miguel's right hand guy.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. Yes."
Right. I mean, those are three, specifically Miguel and Don Neto. They're El Felix brothers, kind of like the, what do they call them? Basically like the second level for the Felix brother family. But the two were, at the time, the most powerful drug. I mean.
Yeah. And I've seen the Netflix thing, right? Narcos?
Narco Mexico,
yeah. I'm like, oh my God. I'm watching it with my wife saying, "That guy, I actually met
him." Yeah.
He's pathetic. And the other guy, geez.
I was going to say, I mean, that's like, it's weird because, I mean, these were on par with Escobar and Chapo. Like, they're right. That level.
Right.
So the feeling you got from both of them was just kind of like.
Right. And I knew, you know, I looked at into Gallardo's eyes and I knew stone cold killer. He'd ice me if he had a chance and I stood in his way. He'd think nothing of it and talk about his stupid underwear, you know, that type of, I just knew
just these types. Just nothing behind the eyes, yeah.
Cold, pretty cold. I mean, that was a very interesting encounter in the prison. And what was also pretty cool is my partner, the attorney from Washington, you know, here's the warden saying it can never happen here and will never happen here. We have all of this, these precautions and all of, you know, all layers of precaution and whatever. And then Howard says, "But your problem is going to be on the inside. It's going to be the guy that works in the cell being paid off." And was he ever right? A few years later,
El Chapo escapes
from the same place. It's kind of funny because I remember as I pulled up to the Altiplano, I remember looking around and seeing, I could swear, I saw this way out in the kind of boonies, but I could see it because there was nothing to impede the sight. It was like a huge field, and there was this kind of, I don't know, this little cabin or barn or something. And I just thought, that's odd. And I maybe in my mind, I thought, tunnel there? Just, you know, just kind of these, the way I think. And maybe that was the one that that they used. I don't know.
Jesus Christ.
I'm just guessing. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe.
No, that's, did you guys ever call up the warden and be like after, be like, "Hey, buddy,
no.
They got out."
No. Smoke and mirrors, man. Smoke and mirrors. Or as they said to me, my friend said, mirrors and smoke.
God, man, I couldn't imagine. It's just crazy because, I wasn't even putting that together when you were meeting all these guys. And I was like, damn, this is a pretty top-notch prison. And the whole time he's like, no one will ever escape. No one will ever escape. Yeah. And then, and El Chapo ended up escaping. And you're like, oh my God, man. And not even like escape. I mean, literally how you guys predicted it. He paid off the warden. They threw him in a laundry basket.
Exactly.
And there's even rumors too that he just walked out the front door. Like not even if you go into the whole.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I saw the video of him disappearing, you know, in the shower.
Oh, so it was that one. So he escaped twice.
Yeah. This is the one that did with the tunnel.
Oh, well, that's even crazier than, because they were doing heavy construction under there. And actually, I had Yoan Grillo, who's like a narco journalist.
I know who he is.
Yeah.
I'm friends with him. Yeah.
Oh, hell yeah.
Oh, he's a good man. Good man.
We were talking about it.
Great journalist.
Like, how do people not hear construction work going underneath. Yeah. And it's like, well, when you got enough money to buy, you know, some headphones, you're good to go.
Money talks.
Yeah. Man, that's crazy. But anyway, so jumping into some of these prison stories, you know, you highlighted it. So what was the situation going on there? And I guess what were some of the standouts?
Yeah, just contraband. A lot of it was contraband. Paying the guards, letting stuff in. And they, you know, it's the slippery slope type of thing. They start, hey, I need a hamburger. Can you get me a hamburger? So once that happens and the guard helps him, now he's got you.
Mm-hmm.
I need a hamburger and a cell phone, you know. And so that now you're on that slippery slope. He says, hey, but you got me a hamburger. I don't want to get you in trouble. I wouldn't want to tell anybody. So it kind of starts like that. So I saw a lot of these contraband cases. They were pretty prolific. And then there was the sexual abuse cases. I remember one in Dallas, Texas. And this was kind of interesting because we had this guy dead to rights, and we actually showed up. We sit him down, and he is wired tight. He's wound up. And so I'm just the second interviewee. You know, it's my guy. I'm actually a supervisor. So, you know, Jerry is doing the interviewing. But Jerry's got a laundry list of questions, and Jerry is very stuck into this, the questions, one by one by one. But I'm looking at the guy, and he's, like, just shaking and trembling. And I'm thinking, Jesus, I think he wants to give it up now. So Jerry starts into his preface, and the guy's like, I need to tell you something. And Jerry's like going, no. Like, we'll get there. We'll get there. Now, I have 20 questions first before you talk. And I'm like, Jerry. And finally, I pulled him out. Jerry.
Just hit it.
He wants to give it up. Yeah. Just let him say it. He goes, you think so? I said, yes, I know so. And that's what happened. He gave it up. We didn't have to go through two pages of questions.
Yeah, 2 hours and some donuts.
Right, right. So this was, he was sexually assaulting some of the female inmates.
Mm. How often were you seeing that with a lot of CEOs?
Huh?
It was a lot of correction officers, right? That's for the situation.
Yeah, it did happen. But one of the craziest ones I'll tell you about, it happened in California. And this was a case where the correctional officer is having a relationship with a female inmate. And, you know, we arrest him. And then she's pregnant. We arrest him. And then we go to the U.S. Attorney's office. And for some reason, they decline the case. Because what ensues after that is they get married. And then the guy, you know, he was with his attorney, says, yes, he had relations, shouldn't have done that, but he really loved the girl, had sexual, it's his baby, and they got married, so please keep that in mind. And they threw the case out.
What the hell?
No, they fired the guy, obviously,
yeah.
But they wouldn't prosecute him because he was in love and going to have the baby.
Happily ever after.
It was the craziest. Now, in Texas, that wouldn't have happened.
No.
Only in California.
So, again, so you're seeing with the CEO cases, were you, some of the guys that I've talked to before have said that this usually happens to younger guys because they're just not making tons of cash or they're like easily susceptible to kind of outside. Like, is that the trend you noticed or what was?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it would be the entry level type CEOs. I think you'd see a trend there. But the sexual assaults, young guys, middle-aged, didn't matter.
Sex, as long as they were weirdo.
They can get away with sex. But also, you know, you had to be careful too because there was some very astute prisoners that would, you know, kind of do it on purpose and then catch the sperm and then say I was assaulted and, you know, sue the prison, sue the Department of Justice and make money off of it. So you got to be careful there.
When you were operating on some of these guys as well, it's kind of funny, like a lot of cases involving federal agents, like versus federal agents kind of deal. It's weird because it's almost like they also know the game and everything. Like, sure. Was there ever a worry that there was going to be some type of revenge isn't the right word, but like, you know, some level of like, either coming after you or figuring out before. And you know what I mean? Like kind of that type of thing.
Yeah. You know, I'm sure I thought about it, but I didn't necessarily worry about it. There might be only one guy that I thought he might be still pissed at me. I still might look over my shoulder once in a while. But apart from that, no, I was never really worried. Although, look, you're not going to get any Christmas party invitations from
Probably
these
not.
People. They don't want to see you. And when they see you come, they know there's trouble. So you never, they're not welcoming. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
So looking to wrap up here, if you could pick out, you know, been all over the world, seeing all the best and the worst that the world has to offer.
Yeah.
If you could pick one thing, one lesson learned or one idea that would be something that you would take away that you would want the viewer to be able to either add to their day-to-day or understand, yeah. What would that be?
Well, you know, I touch upon that in my epilogue. You know, I give some advice to men and women like you, young men and women who are considering such a career. And I just lay out what has worked for me in the past and what I would do. You know, listening is such a big part of our job. And I've always adhered to this 80-20 rule where when I'm with a bad guy, bad girl, or whatever, I'm talking no more than 20%. That's my rule. They're talking the 80%. But when you see it in practice over the years, it's not always how it works. I've seen it go the other way, where the agent is, you listen to me, you know, and that's, he's not listening. He's talking, and you're not going to get much out of that. You got to listen, you know. It's so that's my 80-20 rule. That's one thing. The other thing is, you know, and this goes back to a book I read, How to Make Friends, Influence People, by Carnegie, Dale, I think it's Dale Carnegie. It's just, there's, you know, how to interact with people. And again, he'll talk about listening is a big thing. And other things that, how to interact with people, show them respect. That's a big thing. You know, I've been in situations where the agent will not show respect to the person sitting opposite them. And good luck. Good luck getting information from people like that, you know. And I've also seen people that come in with a stone face, you know, like no friendship, no, people are petrified, you know. So I just say kind of act naturally, but, you know, listen to what they have to say. And, you know, I think you'll succeed. You'll make great cases.
Well, Ken, my man, this has been a fun one. If you want to give a quick shout out where people can find you on social media, then also the book. And I know you got tons of other projects going on. So if you just want to shout those out quick.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that. My book is Cop's Son, One G-Man's Fight Against Jihad, Global Fraud, and the Cartels. It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And I'm on all social media platforms, or at least the ones that are well-known. Yeah. You know, I'm on Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and Instagram. So, again, I just want to thank everybody out there that has done this type of job, has served the country. Thank you. Thank you all for your service.
Hell yeah. Well, stay in touch. We're definitely going to get another one here soon down in Dallas, and we'll for that next book coming out. But again, Ken, this was a fun conversation. And yeah, man, for everyone, go get the book. But again, thank you for everything. And yeah.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.